Okay, this is Adam Silver, and I'm the roaming reporter for MotoGPOD, and I'm here in the paddock at Donington Park on Friday morning, and I just happened to bump into Michael Scott, who many of you may know as his wonderful words are published in Cycle News every other week, he tells me. And we're just sat here in the lovely English sunshine, and he's filling up his pipe, ready for a quick chat with us for MotoGPOD. So, so I was telling you, Michael, that MotoGPOD is a podcast that comes out every week. It's run by two guys, who lives in Oregon and one lives in San Francisco. And as I said, they asked me if I meet people to do a quick interview. So how about let's start here. This is the last British Grand Prix at Donington. What are your thoughts on that?
I'm not overcome with sentiment and regret, but I do remember some very fine races. Yeah, we were talking about them at breakfast, some great moments. The trouble with Donington, you see, is that it's very nearly a superb track, but it has those loops out at the back.
Okay.
The chicane and then two hairpin bends, which are a completely different kind of track, demanding braking and a short bike,
right,
if you know what I mean. And the other rest of the track demands a long bike that's sinuous and flowing and graceful, and it's always had this terrible oxymoron in it, and that rather spoils it, I think. And it's I was going to say it's a dump, and I would be right, because you know
you mean the facilities are
yes,
not
yes, I
very...
mean we go to Malaysia, we go to third world countries, new developments, people who've never had Grand Prix, and the facilities are absolutely out of this world, and you come here and it's really a little bit Second World War, and when it rains it's going to get flooded.
Indeed.
You know, and it is going to rain. On the other hand, it has aircraft taking off overhead, that's quite fun.
Yes.
One came down once, you know, and a failed landing and ended with its nose across the perimeter fence.
Oh,
by
boy.
The old hairpin.
Oh, was there any racing going on at the time?
No, it was at night.
Oh, wow.
I think it was at night.
Actually, I think I remember that. I think I was still living in England at the time. So,
yes, it wasn't the... There was another one that crashed on the motorway, a passenger aircraft. This was a transport aircraft.
So, MotoGP, we're... let's see, are we halfway through the season yet, or even further
well,
than halfway?
We're at nine, this is ten, so
okay.
We're more than halfway
through. More than halfway through the season, and we're getting towards, I guess silly season has already started a little bit, hasn't it? What are your thoughts about how the teams are going to shape up next year?
Well, it all depends on Lorenzo at the moment. Will he stay at Yamaha or not? Will he go to Honda? And it's as simple as that, until he makes up his mind. Nobody knows what will happen, and there's a lot of arguments either way, that Honda will pull out the money and buy him and get him, or that he'll decide to stay with Yamaha and carry on racing Rossi. And either way, there's such different prospects that until a decision is made, then it's pointless speculation, really.
What about our friend Mr. Ben Spies, our American...
You see, why isn't he here? What a blunder. What is wrong with Suzuki? What is wrong with Suzuki? What is wrong with him? Why isn't he here? He's such a good rider.
Yeah.
He showed it on a MotoGP bike. And not only did they lose him to Yamaha, they lost him to superbikes as well. He'll be probably dangled on a string, you see. But if Lorenzo goes, then that makes a place at
indeed,
Yamaha.
Indeed.
He won't be able to ride for the factory team for the first year because of the silly rule. But, he'll make a place. I'm sure he's bound here, either next year or the one after.
It will be very...
He's brilliant.
Yeah, he's a fabulous rider, isn't he? I mean, he's really just gone and made his mark in World Superbikes already this year.
Yeah, fantastic.
So...
really good.
All right, well, good. Thank you very much for spending a few minutes with me.
That's a pleasure.
And I look forward to reading more of your comments.
And
hopefully we'll see you out in... America.
Well,
soon.
I'm here. I've got to plug the website gpweek.com.
Gpweek.com. Okay.
Log on. It's a weekly deadline magazine, laid out like a magazine.
Okay.
You know, when people will be interested.
Is this one of your projects?
I'm involved in it.
Okay. Okay. Well.
I'm the MotoGP. When I say I'm involved in it, I'm the one who types his fingers to little stubs. for all you people. There's hardly anything left.
All right, well, let's pray for good weather this weekend. Well, I'm not sure. Oh, who is that?
It's not Ben, is it?
I was just going to say that I believe that is Ben Spees that we were just talking about has just walked right past us. So, jolly...
Chase him down.
Let's go and chase him down.
To MotoGPOD, the internet radio show about motorcycle road racing. Today is July 31st, Friday, July 31st, and this is episode number 188. This is Jules Cisek and Jim Race. Hi, Jim.
Evening, Jules.
What's shaking?
I think we're about to do another MotoGPOD episode. That's pretty damn
sweet. Yeah, we had a great, great weekend of racing. I got hardly any sleep because I like to watch my racing live. it was quite a wacky weekend, both in MotoGP and in Superbikes. Of course, MotoGP, quite wacky. One of the wackiest weekends ever. So let's jump in with that, and then we'll talk about World Superbikes at Brno. So MotoGP was at Donington last time.
The final call.
Yeah, the curtain call. And next year they're going to be at Silverstone for at least 5 years, I heard?
I believe that's the length of the contract, and it's basically a swap with F1 is what it is.
Right, right. And then there was a bunch of people who were saying, I cannot believe that Formula One is actually going to be able to run at Donington because they're just – it's a great track. The bikers love the track. I mean, the riders love the track. But for fans and teams, it's a nightmare because it's really hard to get in and out. The facilities suck. And actually, there was a lot of complaining about the state of the track because there's been some construction, I guess, and some sections had a lot of freshly painted white lines.
Well, I think a big...
even before the race, though, there were people saying, there's the surface is kind of messed up Just general complaints about the maintenance of the actual race surface.
I think a big part of that was because of the and I'm sure my British friends are going to correct me at least on some of this, but part of that is because of the work that they're proceeding to do the upgrades for F1, and so it's. My understanding is there's a fair amount of cash infusion that's going in, and a lot of the things that, you know, the F1 teams and, of course, the GP teams and everybody else has been complaining about are going to be picked up. But I think part of it was also relatively political and probably financial-based as to the cost to Donington for it. And, you know, the switch.
Well, yeah, and then there was also that whole weird – kind of, we owe money to the leasing company.
Yeah.
For a while, during which I think all construction was basically halted while they were working that out, right? Because there was no, they weren't sure what they're even going to be able to have a race here.
Yeah, well, watching it from afar has been pretty weird. I kind of wish I was a little bit closer to the action because you're right. There was we weren't even sure if we were going to have it. Then there were concerns about safety because of modifications that have been made for F1, yeah. Runoff and whatnot. But of course, you know, the thing is so weird and it's kind of hard for a lot of people to wrap their minds around is that the requirements for runoff and areas are like that are totally different between motorcycle road racing and car racing. Just the vehicles have different dynamics when they crash or go off course, and so you know while one may be safe for one may not be safe for the other, and vice versa.
Yeah, totally true. Because they're still racing it in Montreal, for example. Like you would never see a motorcycle out there. I mean, that's a track that doesn't have runoff, except you know that in the hairpin.
Yeah,
because a lot of tires, and you know, when people crash there, and when Formula One drivers crash there, there's they survive, but there's no way a motorcycle rider would. Like, motorcycle guys need runoff. We saw that at Sachsenring because there was a lot of bikes bouncing off that that air fence.
Sure.
Dunnington doesn't have that much of an issue with this. I think there's the only place where you could possibly have some problems is at the S's.
Yeah.
There's a lot of very tricky corners that can really wipe you out. As we know, Haga got hurt seriously at Kappes when he was racing there. But that was just because of the way the bike landed on top of him like 10 times.
Yeah, the one thing that Donington has, they do have pretty good runoff, and their gravel tends to be groomed really well. But when you speak of the S's, not only Kappes, but like Fagerty and whatnot, especially during the 125 race, you saw guys go off. Same thing with Rossi. Guys go off halfway through on their bikes. Can end right back on course and take out four people. So,
right. Because it's grass on the outside, so it's not like there's gravel that will just hold onto the bike.
Right.
Which actually, allowed Rossi to get back in the race. We'll talk about that in a sec. But in general, the atmosphere was kind of for the swan song for the track. I don't think it was that great for the riders to see the track in a crappy condition. I think they all wanted to just really enjoy the race and not have to worry about bumps here and strange surface changes there. And it's a very slippery track in the wet. So it's known to be slippery in the wet, which is kind of crazy considering how often it is wet there.
Sure.
And so on the positive side, we had an incredibly successful Riders for Health Day of Champions there.
Yeah, that's some big bank, 177,000 pounds, something like that.
Yes, yeah, which is fantastic. Every single rider from MotoGP was present. Most of the 250 and 125 guys were there. Tons of stuff went. I guess Lorenzo painted a painting. Yeah, Africa with a little Lorenzo land in it.
Yeah,
which was supposed to be pretty good. I actually finally got to see the picture. It was, I'll give it like a C.
Well, he doesn't get paid to paint. Although I think what I read was that he had thoughts or ponder actually even attended an art school in his youth and decided that. That probably either wasn't where the money was or wasn't where the babes were, or wasn't all that exciting swinging a brush around.
Well, I mean, they gave him a piece of paper and a crayon, and then he turned around and said, well, can I have some canvas and some paint oils? So that's pretty cool. So, yeah, huge success for riders. That's really great to see. Having been like kind of sort of involved with the Day of Stars here at Laguna, we're hoping that we could do something like that again next year.
Sure.
And get that going. Riders raised like 20,000 at Laguna, which is pretty awesome too. Much smaller. Day of Champions is a gigantic event, and I'm sure that when Adam Silva gets back from the UK, we'll get him on the show We'll hear him say more about that. Okay, so let's get to qualifying in the race of MotoGP.
Sure. So qualifying. Jules and I have been talking a fair bit about track conditions and whatnot, and track conditions for qualifying were in the wet. They weren't. Track conditions for qualifying were. In the dry, were they in?
Yeah, I got burned by that too because there was a for some reason I thought it was in the wet because I've been corresponding with Jim Garrison for a couple of weeks now. He challenged the notion that Laguna had not allowed the 125 250 classes because the their times would be so close, and he actually emailed me and pointed out that the slowest guy on the 800s at Donington during qualifying was Gabo Tamachi with a 131.193, and the fastest guy on the 250s was Hector Barbera on he did a 131.802, so only like 7/10 off the pace of the 800s. Short track, but still, that's pretty close. So that's a good point that Jim Garrison made. And the first thing that came to my mind was, well, you know, that's because the MotoGP guys were in the wet. And then I was like, oh, wait a second, they weren't in the wet. It was just not, it was not great conditions, but it wasn't definitely not wet.
I think the reasons for because we've all complained about it, and I don't think you attended, but back when I was first going to GP's Laguna, there were 250s, and I'm thinking back there, I believe there were 125s, so maybe not. But I think a lot of it is just the support races, and for whatever reason, Scramp and the people that run Laguna Seca seem to think that the sprint races are really important, although maybe not so much this year with a bit of a debacle that the AMA had. But it's also a financial thing. You know, it costs a lot of money to ship those things around, and especially for Laguna Seca from Saxon, or you know, last year it was, what was it, Laguna Seca back to Saxon Ring. So, it, you know, it was week after week after week, and, you know, it's really hard to and expensive to move all that stuff around. When you drop the support classes, you're removing, you know, essentially maybe half of the material that needs to be moved around. That can save a bunch of money,
I suppose. But my counter to the cost issue would be that in 2005 we didn't have a cost issue.
Well, so, that's true. You know,
I mean, teams weren't worried about his cost as much as they were about just you know, like, it would be. I mean, it's just an ideal track for smaller bikes, so it's always been kind of like, and a bummer for me because I'm right here.
Well, you
2 hours away, so
always go to Laguna again, or I mean Indy again.
Yep.
So I'm just going to run through the qualifying order here. Again, it was dry. Your top three front row would have been Rossi, Pedrosa, and Lorenzo, followed by
and Rossi snagged it like again on the last lap, kind of out of nowhere.
Lap 29. In fact, I believe on that one he broke the track record by over a half a second, which is pretty impressive considering that he was saying that the track wasn't in that great shape.
Right.
And that track record, which he broke, his fastest lap was lap 29. It was faster than the circuit best lap or circuit record lap, which is normally was race tires, but you kind of have to assume that the softs that they had here this weekend were closer to race tires and qualifying tires. Does that make sense?
Yep. Makes sense.
So front row, Rossi, Pedrosa, Lorenzo. Second row was Stoner, Dovey, and Edwards, and good qualifying spot for Edwards. So, you know, your top four seem to be the ones that have been in the same place all the time, and not so surprising.
Yeah, definitely not.
Your third row, you're looking at Melandri, Elias, and Toslin. A good qualifying effort from James. He really needs it, and certainly on his home soil. And, you know, Marco, we can't praise him too much. I guess we could, but still doing great and a good job for Tony. On your fourth row, you've got Depunier, Callio, and DeAngelis. Fifth row is Vermeulen, Caparossi, and Nicky Hayden, who is, you know, unfortunately, after the really good results or really good looking work at both Laguna Seca and Saxon Ring, was kind of back in the old spot again. Mm-hmm. And on your last row, you're looking at Nick Canepa and Talmashi.
And Hector Barber almost.
You know, it's an interesting consideration, but I think if you look at lots of tracks and they're not that far off. Here's some wild speculation. We don't have to go on about this for a while, but maybe that's one of the reasons they're bringing in the Moto2 guys. You know, kind of I don't know. They're supposed to be as fast or faster. We'll see.
Yeah, we will. Especially if they throw in those Moto1 rules.
Yeah, I need to write that down too. Maybe we'll talk about that next week. Because it is kind of interesting, even if it's just more bluff than bother.
Yep. Okay, and the race itself was just a. I love how Yamaha. So Yamaha, put out a statement from their typical PR post race stuff, and And they said it was a very intense, that Colin Edwards said it was a very intense 48 minutes, which is not really what he said. What he actually said was that it was 28 minutes of pure hell that he wouldn't wish.
That's not what he said either.
Okay, so go ahead, say exactly what he said.
I'm not a very religious person, so it was 48 minutes of bullshit.
That's right. That's a very good Colin impersonation, bullshit. And he wouldn't wish it on his worst enemy, so... they toned it down for the PR. I found that really funny. Because the problem was that it never got really wet, too wet to really warrant switching to wet tires, but it was raining. So everybody was just, for those full 48 minutes, was riding, you know, every corner, they were twitching and they could have gone down. Lots of guys did go down. Tony Elias went down spectacularly.
Let's hang on for a second. Let's take a step back because there's one big thing that we should probably cover because it was kind of the
That's right. On the starting grid, we had two guys that decided to roll the dice.
Exactly. And interestingly enough, it led into a bit of a deeper vision into how, at least for us, do Ducati Corsa team works, because in this particular case, and I'm going to guess this was not a popular decision to make amongst that team's management, but Casey Stoner chose to run with wets. And Nicky Hayden did as well, while the entire rest of the field chose to run on slicks. And in the end, that made all the difference in the world.
Yeah, and so, you know, both Stoner and Hayden defended their positions after the race. Stoner was very honest about it. He said, you know, basically, if the race was going to be dry... I'm paraphrasing a little bit for what he said, but this is the way I hear what he said. If the race was going to be in the dry, he was not going to be competitive. So I want to be on the wet just because I may if it starts to rain, I may not have to go into the pits. It was more like, It's gotta be wet for me to win, so I might as well just be on the wet tires and just hope that the race will. I mean that the weather will turn and it'll start raining for real. Go ahead.
What you're intimating there, and not quite saying, which is kind of important, and I think he also brought this up after the race, is that, well, first off, in the warm up for the day was also wet. And, you know, that's probably the closest indicator as to what they're going to have to deal with. And he was a half second faster than anybody else, even though he qualified in fourth. So he had a night, and, you know, he did one of his little lightning rushes, less laps than anybody else. But he also was pretty clear in the post-race interviews, this is Stoner speaking, was that he still didn't feel that his health was up to running a full race in the dry. And you know, so that was what you said. You know, he felt that he could do well in the wet, but it's a little scary because if he's we had an idea after Laguna Seca and all the time that he spent in Dr. Ting's clinic that he was in better shape. So without, you know, over going into this right now, it appears that there still are some physical issues. Whatever those are caused by that he's having to deal with. So, you know, he took a gamble. He threw the dice and they came up snake eyes. But it was an interesting call, not the right call. And the Livio Supo interview afterwards was you know, brutally honest. You know, he said he'd been talking to Kevin Schwantz on the grid before the race. And he told Kevin that we'll either be idiots or heroes. And he said, well, today we're idiots.
Yeah, and you know what's interesting is that why did Nick do the same thing? It seems to me that it would have been a much better strategy to have one of them on wets and one of them on dries, so that one of them, so that they could be getting data from both, but just by what, I mean, obviously they're not, there's no communication between the bikes and the crew during the race, but they could at least see, okay, Nick is not struggling. Let's get Casey in here and put him on dries, or Casey's doing really well. Let's get Nick in here and put him on wets. I found it very strange that Nikki also, because I don't think that it was just purely Nikki's choice. I think that Nikki's a good team player.
I'll agree with you. Yeah, I did. Yeah. If you're going to throw anybody on wets, throw the guy that isn't in the points chase out of it.
Yeah.
The bottom line is that it seems to make the most sense, because you don't want to gamble when you're racing right now. I mean, not when you're still close to the front, and to have the result that they had was disastrous to Stoner's championship hopes. You know, it didn't throw him out of the running, but it knocked him down a good bit.
Yeah, yeah. The other thing you might want to consider is that it takes a lot of pressure off him. You know, that it did happen. If it was a full wet race, he could have done really well, and that would have taken some pressure off as well. So, I just don't understand why they put both of those guys in the same position. I guess maybe they were using satellite bikes as their litmus test of their taking that big chance. And you know, one thing to remember is that Ducati is very well known for going against the grain like this. I mean, they were the first manufacturer to really embrace Bridgestone, well, they didn't have to, because they did have Michelin knocking on their door all the time, and they chose to switch to Bridgestone because it gave them not an edge, but something different, something where they were basically saying, well, we can't beat Rossi on, this was back in the day when you know, Rossi had his special Michelins.
Sure.
We can't beat Rossi on the Michelins because he's always going to have a better tire than us. So we're going to go to a totally different manufacturer, even though we're going to struggle at first, and they did. That in the long run, it'll pay off. And it was a huge gamble that did pay off, because then they developed the tire that is now the best tire in GPs, and, well, the only tire now, but but it was the best tire. And, you know, so this is not that surprising that they would do something so strange. It was seemingly so strange.
I think the thing that was most surprising to me was that they didn't, take the opportunity to rectify it. And whether or not that would have put them farther down rectify it during the race. I was really surprised that Stoner never pitted. And because the tires were totally shagged after about 6 or 8 laps. And to stay out there on basically completely foobarred wet tires, which shed all of their grooves and rubber in the relative dry that they had, just seemed like a ongoing and endless lesson in futility. But yeah, we should move on. But and I don't think anybody would be surprised by this. But it was kind of one of the low lights of the race.
Yeah, yeah. The last thing I wanted to say on Stoner's behalf, kind of thing, is like, the gamble does make some sort of sense, because he's not fighting just one guy. If it was just Rossi that he was fighting, and they were close together in points, I think that he would probably go out on basically on what the rest of the field was going out on.
Mm-hmm.
But he's fighting both Lorenzo and Rossi. No matter what happens, one of those guys is going to be fighting for the championship. One of them might get hurt for the rest of the season, and you're still going to have the other guy to contend with. So to catch him on a weekend where you're not feeling 100%, I can sort of see why you'd take that chance, get out on the wets, and just say, you know, let's hope that it starts raining, like, you know, within the next 5 laps. Because really, after 10 laps, and this is a 28-lap race, after 10 laps without rain, those wets are going to be useless when it starts raining anyway. So it really had to happen right in the beginning, and it didn't. And at that point, that's the part. That's the part that was kind of shocking, was that they never did go in. You know.
Yeah. Well, I think that the gamble was the kind that you might make with one or two races left, and it's kind of a Hail Mary to try and retrieve something that appears to be out of reach. But that's the thing, is we've still got a whole bunch of races to run. You know, just a little bit less than half the season, and doing that this early seems to be a bit risky to me.
Yep. Yeah. So it's a bummer because we like to see Stoner mixed up in there. We like to see the resurgence of Nikki. Obviously, we have no idea how Nikki would have done in the race otherwise. The other Ducati guys definitely did better. So,
yeah, and I think it points out to us, and I think you and I are of the same manner of thinking, is that while rain races may be relatively exciting to a viewer from spectacular standpoint, they really do have a tendency to throw wrenches into the works. And, you know, it certainly wasn't a processional race from the...
No, it was a very exciting race, but it was almost like you know, oh, let's just really just randomize these riders and put some people on the podium, new people on the podium, you know. Especially this kind of race where we did actually have... The race was declared wet, and people did go in and change their tires, which actually did make a big difference for the guys who didn't have to go in. It's the ultimate randomizer, and not necessarily in a good way. It's more than an equalizer. It's not truly an equalizer like a lot of I think fans like to say, because they've heard racers say it, but the racers are talking about a full wet race. They're not talking about drizzle.
Right. And the finishing order did not have that equalizer quality of, guys with lesser power can win. It was more of a lottery. You know, it was like the Colosseum with, you know, there's a bunch of Christians and a bunch of lions, but, you know, how many are going to be left standing at the end? And frankly, those kind of conditions are just horribly miserable, because you've got no idea what the track condition is going to be like from corner to corner, because you can't see the water.
Yeah, exactly. And from lap to lap, it was changing.
Yeah, and the whole bottom line is, and anybody that's ridden motorcycles at speed will know this, is that, so let's say you get a flurry of raindrops on your windscreen, right? Well, at, you know, 150 miles an hour, that flurry is gone and behind you, but if you get it into your mind that is the condition 100 yards down the track, you're really screwed up, because it might be perfectly dry there. And the rain was just very erratic and not very consistent.
Yeah.
If there's anything that riders want in any world-class or world championship, is either dry or wet, not something in between, and not something that's variable during the length of the race. So we had some surprises in the first couple of laps, because your usual people that you would expect to be up there even in the rain, you know, we already talked about the grid, but the guy that got the hole shut is somebody that none of us expected and led the first few laps.
Well, yeah, Pedrosa didn't get his hole shot, which I totally was surprised by.
But who did? Tony the Tiger, man.
Yeah, that's Tony the Tiger did. And paid the price.
Yeah, well, but he paid the price. But he
was, I know later he did, yeah. Later, but
he was running really well for a couple of laps in some conditions that had everybody keeping the reins in. I tell you, so you were talking about wide lines before, and Donington's aren't known as the most grippy. But as soon as the second that I saw his rear tire hit that white line down in it was in Craner, right?
I think so, yes.
As soon as I saw his rear tire hit that line, even before it started to go out, I'm like, that's not good. And he crashed right in front of Pedrosa. And I, for a second, thought that he would at least balk or freak Pedrosa. But he kept on a good pace.
Yeah. I wasn't quite sure how you wanted to cover this race, because covering it lap by lap, it was such a chaotic race. I don't think that I really want to do it that way. I was kind of thinking, let's go down the finishing order, and let's just talk about what happened to everybody there.
Sure.
But I guess, well, let's talk about the guys who didn't finish. So Elias crashed out five laps in. On the next lap, Lorenzo, who had now gotten into the lead and was looking very good, crashed at Goddard at the very end there.
Is it Kappes that is final?
No. Kappes is going up the hill, but just before the Dunlop straight.
At the last corner.
Yeah, at the last corner. And it was a very strange crash because it's just he was upright and then he was down. You know, it wasn't like he was even leaning the bike. He looked like he broke a little bit later. He was being chased by Rossi and Dovey. And that was really strange. I mean, he touched the white line, yes, but he didn't even have a lean angle yet. It's just all of a sudden he was down.
Jules, it doesn't take any.
I know. I mean, I've crashed in a wet, so I know how it is. But it was so unexpected that even when you're watching, you're like, what? What just happened? Did I see that? You know.
And frankly, those are some of the worst types of crashes because the time from vertical to horizontal is so fast.
Right. And there's no preparation for it, and your body doesn't prepare for it. So yeah, I agree.
Yeah. You could see he hit hard, although if it rang his bell, he didn't show it very much. But when he went to retrieve his bike from the air fence or the bales or whatever they have at the end of that straight, clearly it was too damaged to continue. And he was pissed. He was mad.
Yeah, he was mad. Unfortunately, you know, like when that section of the track, the runoff actually has a lot of asphalt, so there's a lot of grinding going on. Andrew Wheeler, the photographer that's been on the show, he's incredible photographer, one of my favorites, was standing right there, and the bike was coming at him, and he was looking through the lens, and going, "Oh, I think I better get out of the way. This thing's coming straight at me.
I better de-zoom."
So he's got an interesting shot of Lorenzo's bike kind of parked on. It looks like it's parked on a peg or two, but it's actually coming at him at 100 miles an hour. I'll post a link to that.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Lorenzo was out, and now let's just go straight to the end, I guess. The race was won by Dovizioso.
In his first win.
In his first win. It was only his second podium because he and Rossi broke off on their own, and they really did break off. They were way ahead of everybody.
Like seven or 8 seconds, something like that.
Yeah, I think so. I think it was as much as that. And Rossi later was kind of funny because he was congratulating both Dovey and Edwards and just saying, you know, Edwards more because Dovey really was benefiting from me leading the race because Rossi was leading the race until he fell at the S's, the Fagerty S's. And now the thing is, here's where, like, Lorenzo was unlucky and Rossi, who is one of the luckiest riders ever, because think about how many times he's fallen off and gotten back on and gotten to get some points. He fell off. The bike didn't slide back onto the track, which would have been terrible for Dovizioso because he would have slammed right into it. But it also, it meant that there was really almost no damage to the bike. So Rossi was able to get, even though the bike was turned around, I think that was the biggest issue, was that the bike was turned around. He had to turn it around before rejoining the race. But he was able to get back out there. And on top of that, a lot of the riders that were in front of him decided to pit like a few laps later and change to full wets because it did start getting a little bit wetter. Not much, but a little bit wetter. Whereas Rossi felt like, you know, he may as well just keep going on the slicks. So he benefited from some riders pitting. And he rode still like a demon because he did catch James Tozend, who was running on the slicks and passed him, and Rossi ended up fifth.
Well, if you think about it, I think he joined the race in 11th.
Yes.
And came back through a whole bunch of people that were in various states of discombobulation with weather. One of the things that I kind of like to do is, and of course not now, but people might find it of interest, would be to look at the lap times from MotoGPOD. or I'm sorry, MotoGP.com. Whoops, sorry guys, sorry Dorna. And look at the average lap or the lap times per rider, because I think what you'll see is that it goes up and down and up and down. You can probably chart the weather by that pretty accurately.
Yeah. Good point. And so I think Rossi kind of benefited from some of the pitting, but he did pass a bunch of people, including James Tozen, who didn't pit and stayed out there. And then we had Edwards and Depuñé, who Depuñé was ahead of Edwards and making incredible time. He passed Dovizioso about halfway through the race, and then just kept it on. The great equalizer also means that some riders that have nothing to lose take bigger chances. And Depuñé and Edwards definitely took bigger chances than the rest of the field, because they were 3-4 seconds faster than almost anybody else out there. And the Viziosos did stay on board his bike, but he was getting caught. And huge props to him, because in the end, it looked like they were just going to cruise right past him, and he turned it up.
Exactly. Yeah. He cranked it up when he had to, and that was some smart things, some smart riding. The little mini battle that Edwards and Depuñé had in the last couple of laps was pretty interesting, because he knew Colin was charging, but I think it went through his mind when he managed to pass Randy one or two times was probably a genuine concern that if Randy was willing to pass him back, then Colin didn't want to get taken out by him.
Right. So he actually saved it at the very end, if that was really the case of saving it. Because I think Colin, both of them had the pace to overtake Dovi like three laps from the end by far, because they were gaining about 4 seconds per lap. I mean, it was that much of a difference. Dovi did crank it up, but those guys did crank it down a little bit as well. I think they were afraid of the possibility of contact, and nobody would want to be the guy that took out the leader. Nobody wanted to be, and they were already starting to calculate, my God, I can be on the podium. So.
Well, and
they were.
I don't think there was a single – I'm sure there's somebody out there that despises him to the bone, but there's an awful lot of Colin Edwards fans, and so many people were rooting for his first victory.
I was thinking to myself, it's great if Dovi wins, but when I saw Edwards coming, I was like, nothing would make my day more than if Colin won this race. He's been in the GPs for – I think he just reached a very distinguished kind of marker, which is that he has won. He has been on the podium 11 times without a win. It's the most in the 500 MotoGP class.
That's. I don't think that's necessarily a
distinction,
a badge of pride that he wants to wear.
Yeah,
there was a really good piece on Superbike Planet that Julian Ryder wrote that kind of summarized the state of affairs in that particular race, and I encourage everybody to go look for it. Superbikeplanet.com. We'll put a link up for it. And Colin is definitely quotable, but we digress again. So our podium was Dovizioso, Edwards, and Depuñé. Fantastic there. Depuñé's first podium since I can't remember when. Can you remember when?
I think he was on the Kawasaki.
Okay.
So that must have been two seasons ago at the earliest. I think it was Nakano that got Nakano in 2006 in Assen. I don't remember.
Which is fine. And then the next three up were De Angelis Rossi, who, having remounted, made a fight and charged back through the field. And, good for him. Go Piano Man, James Tozen in six.
Yep. Doing the track invasion was kind of funny because, the typical Donington track invasion did happen. Riders kind of had to sneak their way back to the garages. Some of the riders were kind of, I think, overwhelmed. I think I saw a shot of Niccolò Canepa just sitting out there like,
how do I get back?
Guys, can I get through, please?
Go ahead.
And Tozen, on the other hand, was riding from fan to fan, getting slapped in the back. It was almost like he was really just soaking it up. I think that it was nice to see he does know how to treat his fans. It's nice when riders do that.
Absolutely.
You actually saw him steering into the bigger groups of fans, like, yeah.
I'm pretty sure that he wasn't back into the pits until after the guys in Parc Fermé were already walking up to do the trophy presentation, which is, you know, a fairly long period of time. It was like 15 minutes.
Yeah, yeah. Nick Harris and Gavin were like, oh, my God, he's still out there.
Yeah, and I think part of it is he actually ran out of gas, but I think he probably ran out of gas near the pit entrance. But you're right. He was treating the fans, and make no mistake, even though he hasn't had the most stellar, you know, couple of seasons here, he is still a huge fan favorite, you know, much like Nicky Hayden is in the States. So
right. Exactly.
And so good on them for being that supportive and whatnot. And hopefully with this result, this might boost his stock a little.
Right. Right. Number seven, Melandri. He was actually a little disappointed, he said. Because I think that's in the wets. He was one of the guys who did pit.
Yes, he did.
So he was actually the first finisher that pitted.
Indeed, and we'll notice a very clear pattern here because now that we're down to seventh place, we'll start seeing the guys that did pit and it didn't work out for him so well.
Right, right. So he did pit, and he was a little disappointed because I think he probably feels that he should have stayed out on the slicks.
Mm-hmm.
He probably would have finished ahead of Rossi. He was one guy that Rossi did not get to pass. Nicola Nepa, that's the best result he's ever had, eighth. And Kallio being 10th means that the satellite guys really benefited from not going to the full wets at the start of the race, even though they both did pit eventually. And then Danny Pedrosa was smack in the middle of those two guys in 9th, and he did stay out in the slicks, but he was having serious problems. I don't know whether it was mechanical or just confidence. He's not known as a good... wet weather rider. He was, well, he wasn't, but he actually is a pretty good wet weather rider these days. But like I said, this is not a full wet race, and maybe these kinds of conditions were just completely unsuited to his setup and his style.
I'm partially convinced that because what I saw from him was actually a very timid race. As soon as he would see some rain, he would automatically slow down, whether or not it was something that forced him to slow down, and I thought timid, you know, like a little, you know, he needed to be more aggressive, but then it pulled me back to his injuries that are relatively surface borne, and so you're looking at, you know, his knees, his wrists, and whatnot, and there's a very good possibility if you push beyond the limits of what the adhesion can deal with that you'll go down hard on those very bony parts. So.
Yeah, yeah, good point. Good point. And, you know, I'm sure you know this. I know this. When you ride a lot and you do crash, that memory, those memories of those injuries is very, very strong. Like I still remember a nasty crash I had, like, you know, 7 years ago now. And when I'm in a situation that's very similar to that particular crash, I remember everything about it. The pain, everything comes back, and it's like your bones start to ache and. A guy who's, you know, in a condition that like Danny, I could totally see backing off a little bit, going, damn, my hip, my, you know, whatever it is.
But at the same time, there's, and I totally agree with you that you're even if you're, my guess is, because I clearly can't speak or think for them, but even at these levels, these guys are able to do a whole lot of mental manipulation to put things out of their mind. It still sticks. Probably not nearly the level of us, you know, lowly
guys
that race or do track days, but your subconscious will unfortunately force your wrist to do things that perhaps you don't really want to do.
Right.
I do want to point out something to you for the guys that flanked Pedrosa there, both Canepa and Kallio. That's the first time in any time that I can remember that both of the guys in the satellite team finished ahead of the factory team, even if it was under very unusual circumstances.
Very interesting. Yeah, yeah. Well, I guess you could say in Assen, Gersini finished in front of Repsol because Repsol didn't finish.
Yeah, I mean, not counting crashes.
Right.
Highly unusual.
It was very unusual. Very good point. Loris Caparossi pitted. He was 11th. Gabo Tomasi, I'm not sure if he actually pitted. Do you have that? Do you have the pit enter and exit times or anything like that?
I don't, but I know that he did. He did.
Oh,
pit.
He did go in. Okay. Oh yeah. There was actually even a shot of him changing the bike. Yep. You're right. Vermeulen also pitted. He did terrible for being known as the wet guy. I think he just waited too long to get on the wets and burned a lot of time, you know, poking his way around the track. And then, of course, way in the back, guys who got lapped by everybody, I think, were Stoner and Hayden. Did they actually get lapped by everybody?
I'm pretty sure they did. Wow. They did. It was shown on both one lap down. And in fact, they were being, like, totally courteous backmarkers, getting out of the way when they need to and whatnot. Chris Vermeulen is doing a series on YouTube where he basically, very shortly after the race, is evaluating what happened. And they're usually like little 3 and 4 minute videos.
Yes.
So if you haven't seen it, go to YouTube and do a search for Chris Vermeulen, and you'll get his input in talking about what it was in the race. And he didn't really put it down to any particular factor, just that the conditions were extremely difficult and they didn't quite have handling set up to deal with it. But you're right. He's supposedly a wet weather specialist, and they certainly didn't shine.
Well, he hates being called that, so maybe he wanted to prove them wrong.
Yeah, right.
See, I told you I'm not good. You know that? All right. So that covers the field. One last thing about the podium guys. Have you ever seen a more awkward interview session? I mean, the Vizioso had something to say, sort of, but I think they were all so caught out by being up there in those positions that and totally unprepared.
they really were like kind of okay, what the hell do I say now? I haven't had a media relations person in a while. You know, that was. Yeah, no, it was funny. I mean, the only one that can certainly speak really quickly off the cuff because he's really good at it is Colin Edwards, and he was just his usual howling self.
Yeah.
The BBC interview with Matt Roberts was funny. He's like, I'm too old for this. And then he kind of stops and look at Matt. Matt says, sugar. Sugar, yeah. but yeah, whatever, you know, in a way it was kind of cool. It was, they were almost childlike in their fascination with the
exactly.
Where they ended
up.
I'm
glad you said that. That's a perfect way to sum it up. They were childlike. It was this magical little moment for those guys, and that was fantastic to see.
Yeah, it was I don't know how PG-13 we are, but it was like, holy shit, what am I doing here?
Yeah, well, I mean, the Depunier even said shit. You know, he's like, they didn't get the beeper out on him in time. Of course, I'm sure his LCR press release, you know, said something much nicer. Like,
I don't know why they do it. Come on, throw the emotion out there. You know,
I know. It's just part of the language. Anyway, great to see those guys up there. It was a very strange race. Valentino Rossi extends his lead over Jorge Lorenzo. I mean, those 11 points. Whew,
yeah, that makes
that's huge. I mean, if he had beat Lorenzo by finishing first, Lorenzo being second, that would have been only 5. So
yeah. I mean, think about it. Think about it. He picked up points and everybody closed. You know, Pedrosa in 9th, yeah. Stoner in 14th. That made a big dent in the season. And it's not like Rossi finishes going downhill at the end of the season. So we've got a huge gap between now and the next race.
25 points. 25 points for Rossi. He doesn't even have to race at what's next? Brno. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think he'll go there because he loves that track. So.
I think he'll be there, yeah.
Yeah. And speaking of Brno, unless...
Perfect segue.
well done. So, this weekend we had World Superbike at Brno. And... you know, it too was a bit of a crazy weekend. Weather was great the whole weekend. Actually, it rained a bit on Friday, but not so bad. And most people got some dry practice in. But what did you see?
I saw the Superbike race. I did not see the Super Sport or the Super Stock.
Cool. Well, Superbike race 1 was certainly a bit full of surprises. We had one big incident early and then a surprise winner.
Yeah, I not really a surprise. I have to say that... Every year I really look forward to any race at Brno. For some reason, that track, which looks so lousy when you look at the track map from outside, from up above, it's one of the coolest tracks because it's, you know, the elevation changes. When you combine those corners, the way they're laid out, with the elevation changes, it really is a fantastic racetrack. I would love to see a race there. I would love to photograph a race there because it's got incredible backdrops. But just in general, like, the racing is always really cool. And there's some guys that are just so well suited for it, and one of them is Max Biaggi, because it's a corner speed track, you know.
Exactly, and it's his record there in the past stands out. You know, he's done what, 2 GP500 wins and a World Superbike win. There's no doubt that going into this weekend, he was a favorite. But you know, a lot of people are you know, can the Aprilia factory bike win? And well, it didn't race one, and maybe we should just bomb through this. But
let's just bomb through it. Go ahead.
Well, the first big news of this race was, of course, the pass that Fabrizio tried, a desperation pass, which was kind of stupid with only five laps in, and lost the front and took out both he and Spies. So your running order at that point was Spies, Fabrizio, and Biaggi.
Now, Fabrizio is basically on my shit list now because he really does race in an unsafe manner. I remember at South Africa this year, when it was just him and Haga fighting. You know, I appreciate the fact that a racer goes all out to the end of the race, but he doesn't do it in a what I would call a safe manner. And he almost took out Haga in that race. Every time I see him do a pass, I start to cringe. I'm starting to get used, even though he hasn't really done this since. What was the last time he took somebody out?
I can't really.
There was one time last year where he took somebody out. It was the same exact thing. Oh, he took out Biaggi.
No. Back up there, Chief. What? Go back and look at it. It's the other way around.
What, Biaggi took out Fabrizio?
I believe it. You're thinking at Portugal, I think.
Yeah, Fabrizio ran over to Biaggi and apologized.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Exactly the same way as he did to Spies. No, I'm pretty sure that he took him out.
You are right. For whatever reason, I thought that it was backwards. Yeah, and in fact, you went over to apologize to Max. Kind of did the same thing that Ben did, which is, get out of my face, man.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, so on the fifth lap, we had and at that point, Spies, Fabrizio, and Biaggi had pulled out a decent lead over the secondary pack, which included
Ray
and a host of other
Corser.
Yeah, let's back up even further. We keep doing this. The first two laps of race one, Troy Corser led the field, and the big surprise on lap one was a horrific crash that a charging Chaus had on the first lap, which the bike was like catapulting itself into the sky, and those super high speed spins that you know are going to lead to no good, front end broke off. Unfortunately, in Ruben's crash, he also broke his femur, I believe, on his right side when his leg dug into the gravel trap out there.
Yeah, and he's out for the season, is what I hear.
He may be. It's kind of a weird injury. It's like, you know, pounding the I believe they said it was like the rotator bone or something like that. So that's a shame. But Corser got a great start from the second row, mind you.
Yeah.
And led the field through two laps, which is amazing. The last time we saw that happen was at, Misano, and that was in the wet when Chaus had a couple of laps during tire changes.
Right.
So yeah, that was fantastic. So the beginning was great, real exciting. Then Spies and Fabrizio were out, and you had no idea, you know, what you were really looking at as a race. But
it became kind of processional once we lost Spies and Fabrizio because the first three spots were dialed in.
Sure,
there was a great race for the fourth spot, and you know, Haga was bleeding points and. You know, he ended up finishing what, ninth, I think, or eighth?
Eighth, yeah.
But he was, man. He was in a big group of guys that, and every point counts. So, you know, with Spies not finishing and him finishing in eighth, meant he picked up 8 points, which shielded him from the, you know, almost inevitable bleeding of points in the following race.
Yeah. Fabrizio really kind of steered up the points race there. And I, you know,
good teammate for Haga. Yeah.
Nah, you know, I heard some silly speculation on that, and that's exactly what I'm going to brand it. You know,
there's no way that Fabrizio took out Spies and Purpose. Fabrizio is very much in the running for the championship.
Absolutely.
You know, yeah. And not only that, but you just don't do that kind of stuff. That doesn't happen. And people may say things like this, but I would never believe it.
Yeah, I think we have to believe that it doesn't happen because if you know there was any like. It harkens back to the situation with, well, not really, but with Pedrosa taking Hayden out in 2006. Of course, they were on the same team.
Right.
Regardless, I don't, he's not on my shit list because I think it was incredibly apologetic afterwards and sincere in it.
You know what, though? I don't care how apologetic you are. You know, there's lots of, You could say somebody, you know, beats somebody up and then goes, "Oh, I'm sorry, you know, I was in a really bad mood," or whatever. I mean, the guy just rides out of control, and it was just bound to happen. I mean, I love the fact that he races so with such passion, but he's I don't think his passion matches his passing ability.
That could be. I mean, I see what I see is that he probably you're saying he's riding past his talent, which is probably a very valid argument and a good way to put it. But what I see in him is that his 110% looks from a visual standpoint a lot different than other riders. He never looks smooth. Whereas other riders can make themselves look smooth. Now,
yes, fair. Yeah, that's a fair point. And you know, it's like kind of you could say the same thing about Elias, who in MotoGP rides a completely different line. He looks kind of insane on the bike very often, and you put him and somebody who's riding a regular racing line together, they're going to crash. You know,
sure.
So, but this anyway. I don't want to spend too much time on Fabrizio, and I'm just pissed at him because I think it was too early in the race. It was unnecessary. You know, he did have the pace to keep up with Spies. It's actually a tricky, despite the width of the track, it is a very tricky place to pass because of that smooth style that you have to have to in order to go through all those corners. You do end up having with just one race line, apex to apex, and you know, curb to curb. So it's a tough, and obviously that was very true in the second race. So you know, first race after that fifth lap crash, the podiums pretty much stay the same. Biaggi won. He's extremely popular over at in Brno, and I heard a lot of the commentators were talking about a lot of the Italians coming over because it's really kind of close. But I think people forget just how popular Biaggi was during his 250 days and continues to have a lot of popularity just all over the world. You know, he's a very, you may say what you may say about just the bizarreness of some of the stories about him, but he is a magnetic personality. He's an interesting character and a fantastic racer. So he's got fans everywhere, and it was really cool to see him celebrating. The fans were very happy to see him on the top step of the podium. Aprilia was ecstatic. I mean,
sure.
You know, some of those guys looked like they were going to have a heart attack. you know, I can't wait to see that bike in the flesh when it finally hits the stores and stuff. You know,
you should have gone to Utah.
Well, yeah.
No. I totally agree with you, and Biaggi is like a very small subset of races where you either love him or hate him, and the fact of the matter is probably that there are far more people in the world that love him despite his rather mercurial charisma. and frankly, he totally mellowed a bunch when he went to World Superbike, and I think we need to give him some great credit for that because certainly had to work with a fledgling squad with Aprilia. You know, they've just come out with this brand new bike, and I'm sure he's not completely tamed now, but he did. You're right. He did have a ton of fans there, and probably a lot of it because of his past record. So that was great. I was excited to see. You know, if once I saw that that was a possibility, I was cheering for him all the way.
I always cheer for him to do well. I have a soft spot for Biaggi. I've had a soft spot for Biaggi ever since he got dissed by Honda and MotoGP, which I thought was one of the most unfair. I mean, no matter what you say about him saying things, he's a great racer, and to get blacklisted like that was, I thought, you know, political games in MotoGP just really make me ill.
I blame his uncle. It was all his uncle's fault when he choked Mark Melandri at wherever it was, Assen, I think, a couple of years back.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Race one, excellent result. Biaggi, Checo Rey. And that was fantastic. In fourth place, we had Bern. Corser got a fifth, and Jakob Smerts. Good for him, Guandolini, and Pier Francesco Chili, who runs that team. A nice, solid finish. It looked like the Stiggy Bikes, Haselman, seventh, but John Hopkins, who probably maybe shouldn't have come back so soon, had a crash and hurt himself, and you could seriously, you know, you could see him hobbling along pretty well.
Yeah.
And that
I can't remember the last time I seen Hopper walking normal.
No.
It's really terrible to see.
He's starting to walk like Gary McCoy.
Exactly. God.
McCoy hobble. So Haselman seventh, 8th, 9th, 10th was Haga Legrieve and Tomata, and on down the line. The guys that were out in this were Ruben Chaus, of course, on the first lap. Lonzi, Fabrizio, and Spies went together. Nakano, which I think was a mechanical. John Hopkins.
Yes, it was.
Anthony Palita and Tom Sykes, who also went out with a mysterious mechanical with only one lap to go. That was a real drag because he had a good run going.
Yeah, he was up there in the top 10.
He was, and I believe as we move on, he's a little bit better in race two, but he looked strong. He was running with that at the tail end of that second group.
Yep. Race two turned – there was no Fabrizio incidents.
and in fact, a rather polite running from him.
I guess so. I mean, he's to me, he was a spoiler in both races because I think that he held up Biaggi, but of course that's not – because he was a dick, it was because he was racing.
Well, but look at it this way: I you know, maybe Biaggi would have more laps. So the finishing order before we get cranking on this is Spies, Biaggi, Fabrizio for the podium. Biaggi had five or six laps to, you know, really put it to Ben, and Ben was able to match him and deal with it. And you make a good point. You know, Fabrizio would have been up there if he could, but. He and Biaggi got into a back-and-forth tussle for a while, and frankly, Ben seriously looked like he was determined not to let them get anywhere close, even though he wasn't that far ahead.
Right. Well, as long as Fabrizio was in second, there was a big gap. Well, I mean, you know, we're talking like around a second. The moment that Biaggi got past Fabrizio, which really brings me up to another thing I want to talk about Biaggi, Biaggi has never learned how to pass on power. Not on power, but on brakes. And I think it goes back to his 250 days. I think he's very much a corner speed guy. And I can't count the number of times that he goes wide trying to pass somebody and then just completely goes wide and has to then scramble back not to lose a couple positions, you know? It happens all the time. And in this race, it happened like four times trying to pass Fabrizio. And then when he caught up with Spies, he could not find a way around Spies. He's not a very inventive passer, I would say. He's always trying the same exact thing. And everybody who races against him knows how to that all they have to do is stay on the inside of him and he'll go wide. And Haga knows this. Haga does this to Biaggi all the time when they're together. Is Biaggi will go wide. Biaggi will pass hard by going deep on the brakes, but he's not one of those guys like Rossi who can stop and then turn and get a good drive out. He relies on that corner speed, so he keeps it going through the deep braking maneuver, and that means like he goes wide and then has to reel it back in.
If somebody were to ask my opinion, I think what I mean, part of it's the way that Biaggi passes, which is, you know, usually under the brakes and into a corner, and yes, he can go wide. But I think the other part of it that you can't discount is the development curve of the RSV4, because you can, or at least to me, I can clearly see the thing really squat bad. And a squatting means that it's the swing arm angle gets near to flat when they get on the power coming out of a corner, and that will, in a lot of cases, tend to make the bike want to stand up on the exit. Mm. So you can brake as hard as you want going in and pass somebody, but if you end up with an early apex and have to make the next one late, or, you know, early slash late as well, for the second corner, as soon as you're getting on the power to try and keep that edge, even if it was a block pass and the rear end squats, there's no way that you can keep the thing tight to the corner. And that's what it looked like to me. It was a combination of his passing technique that you mentioned and also the bike's tendencies when under power leaned over.
You're probably right, although I think that I think you're definitely onto something there. But I mean, this was the case on the M1. This was the case on the Suzuki. This was the case on the Dux. It's probably just the way he sets the bike up. You know, I mean,
it very well could be, and we really don't have a whole lot of comparisons to do with the performance of that RSV4, because Nakano really hasn't been anywhere up near the sharp end. And even if he was, got a very different style compared to Biaggi.
Right. But anyway, so I was, of course, rooting for him to win, not because I'm a Haga fan or anything like that, but because I am a Biaggi fan. And, you know, Spies was going to get some load of points anyway. I was happy to see that he did give it a good fight, although he took him so long to pass Fabrizio. I there was no doubt in my mind that he would just not be able to do it to Spies. Spies is a really wily racer. I think that, I mean, we've said this many times, racing against Matt Bladen is probably the best school of racing that anybody's ever gotten. So Spies knows all the tricks that people will try to pull on him, and he did a fantastic job out front, because he was Biaggi definitely had the fastest bike. The fastest bike plus rider combo on the track. So it was Spies blocking and being a very, very smart racer that allowed him to win that race. And eventually Biaggi did make a small mistake, and so I think there was a couple of bike lengths at the end.
Yeah, and it was a really, really, you know, good race for it. It was a great race. It was a solid race to the finish, and the last five laps were kind of knuckle biting, because you really weren't sure if Max was going to take pull a real aggressive move on Ben. But in that same softening his character moving in a World Superbike, I think he's also afforded, and it seemed like he had since the beginning of the season, some respect to Ben. So maybe, you know, he knew something that we thought we knew already. But I think, frankly, everybody in the States is even kind of shocked by Spies' success. So good on him, and it's elevated the sports profile here in the States, and I'm all for that.
And despite the fact that Haga, you know, so Haga did very, very well in the second race. He finished sixth. You know, Ben took a lot of points back. We're now going to have a very long period. I think 6 weeks, right?
Mm-hmm.
Before the next race. So
yes, sir.
So Haga gets a lot of rest, and he still maintains his lead with seven points. So it's going to be, I think, a fantastic finish to the season. I think Ben feels that because of what happened in race one, that he should have come out of this weekend ahead, and rightly so. But I think for the championship, actually, it'll be better, because I think there'll be nothing worse than like speculating for the rest of, you know, off season and part of next year about, well, if Haga had been 100% healthy, what Ben Spies would have been able to win the championship, you know, all that kind of stuff. So Now we're going to have, I think, a much healthier Haga, a very close race going into the next round, and it's going to be a fantastic finish.
Yeah, no, I think so as well. And I can't imagine at this point that people would try and, you know, 2006 Haydenize whatever this championship is going to end up being, because there's been bad luck on both of the top guys' spots, or all three of them, or however you want to count it.
Right.
And it's a hard fought season. And may the best rider win. You know, good teams, great management, and let's give all the props to the teams, because they're the ones, you know, really getting these guys on bikes to make it to the end.
Absolutely.
So cool. Yeah. No, World Superbike, at least the Superbikes, was really exciting, quite dramatic, and pretty cool. But we also had a really good Super Sport race, which is always fun from that.
I did not get to watch it, so just give us a very quick rundown.
Sure. The 2 minutes or 1 minute synopsis, I can do it. And then, of course, the guys that are leading the championship battle, top two, are Cal Crutchlow of Yamaha and Eugene Laverty from Parker Honda. And Eugene had a big crash in warm-up, ended up having to run his number two bike. But the first couple of laps, when they were going crazy, were the Motocard Provec, or Provec Motocard, I believe it's his, Kawasaki's of both the scorers, and Fujiwara. And those guys led the first couple of laps, a huge battle at the front, until Cal got like a huge lead, maybe 10 or 15 seconds. And or somewhere around lap, maybe with about 8 or 9 to go, Foray had pulled up behind them, Cal's teammate, and Anthony West as well. In the last four laps, if you haven't seen it, last lap, frankly.
Well, I've seen the results, and I think they were all separated by like 1/10 of a second or something like that.
And there were like 7 passes for the lead in the last lap. You know, classic World Super Sport racing. And
but Cal retired with a mechanical, right?
Cal retired with a mechanical, and Eugene was way back in 6th or 7th and would have lost a whole bunch of points to Cal, but ended up picking up something like 11. So he's within a little pebble's throw of him now. And I mention Eugene because we talk to him all the time. But yeah, no, a great finish. If you have any chance to do it, YouTube, wherever, you know, record on TiVo, record on anything, watch at least the last, say, 5 laps of the Super Sport race. You will not regret it.
Before I go, I want to remind everybody that Isle of Man TT is on Discovery Channel in HD these days. Really, really, really worth watching, especially if you want to know why you should put the milk in first before you pour the tea in.
I don't think that Guy Martin interview. Oh, well, you've only got the first one, the emulsion interview.
I've seen them all already, but not in HD yet.
The ITV4 stuff. What Discovery HD Theater is doing is fantastic, and thank you very much to them for bringing this kind of stuff to a U.S. audience. It's awesome. You know, this is going to be running weekly again at 9 o'clock Pacific time for quite some time. I think we've got another maybe 9 weeks or so to go. And if you haven't seen this stuff in HD, it's way cool. But I think the next episode, we had Superbike on Monday night.
Yep.
And the first Superbike race. And there's an interview coming up with Guy Martin at their secret workshop on you.
Yeah, right.
It's absolutely special. And frankly, these episodes that they're, I'll do this real quick, Jules, because I don't want to go on. I can run on. Is that they really show that the TT is not just about racing. It really is an event. It's really about a coming together of fans and racers into a very small space. And the TT is really something super special. It's not just a race weekend. It's a race fortnight, if you will, but it's not even just about the racing. It's what got me into road racing over 25 years ago.
Nice. Yeah, it is amazing. And it's kind of a shame that we haven't had good coverage in the States. Basically, like my following of the TT was limited to, you know, reading websites, and before that was like, you know, catching highlights. To have the ability to watch this thing on a cable HD is amazing. It's so cool, and such complete coverage too. So that's really, really cool.
It's the absolute advance, and you know, Discovery HD Theater is going to, I guess, morph into something called Velocity next year, and I'm really looking forward to seeing what they bring to us, because they're focusing a lot on motorsports coverage, and they're filling in the niche that a little channel called SpeedVision used to handle back when they were not so NASCAR oriented. It was a super drag. But yeah, props to them. Yeah, when I first started getting into road racing, I used to ride my motorcycle out to this tiny, in San Francisco, this tiny little guy's house, and he was the U.S. distributor for Duke Video, which everybody that likes motorcycle racing will be familiar with. And I would get the videos like a month and a half, 2-3 months afterwards, and that's how I would find out what was going on. This back in the early 80s.
Yeah, no, it's true. Actually, I have like 3 or 4 TT review DVDs from Duke.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. A couple other things just to touch on. The 2010 MotoGP provisional schedule.
Oh, yes. Thank you for reminding me. We definitely want to go over that before the end of this particular show.
Yeah. Was announced today, and there's clearly quite a few changes. We talked about Silverstone earlier. It looks like Hungary's Balatonring is back in, at least penciled in this year. And then there's a whole new circuit, which is kind of weird because it's the Spanish circuit. We've already got 3 Spanish races and the potential for a 4th. They call it their reserve circuit. Did you see that?
Yeah. What do you think? Do we know what that actually is?
Well,
it's going to be.
Yeah. And it's, if you go around 2.com and you'll see the provisional schedule there, you'll see a link to that circuit, and that circuit seems like it's pretty well advanced as far as, you know, paving and everything goes. It's a sticky in the MotoGP conference. And that's, it's Motorland Aragon circuit, which is kind of an industrial area. And what, you know, it's an interesting looking circuit, but boy, 4 Spanish races. And, you know, I know Dorna is in Barcelona, but people are going to be pissed I'm pretty sure the only reason they have it there is just in case the Balaton Ring doesn't get finished. But it seems like Hungary's economy is probably better than or at least more in tune or aligned with reality than the Spanish one, which is also suffering pretty badly, from my understanding, from housing issues.
But other news is that we have Laguna back in a more reasonable slot, not over 4th of July. So that's good for us. But then we've got Silverstone, obviously, which is replacing Donington. What round did we lose?
We didn't check. Well, we lost one this year because we didn't run Balaton Rings.
Sure, sure.
I don't believe we, just glancing at schedule, I don't believe we really lost anything. You know,
how could we not lose anything? There's 18 rounds.
Well, this year we lost one because they're not running Balaton Ring. But there's still 18 rounds scheduled for next season. But they have that reserve circuit, which is the Aragon one in Spain.
No, but hang on a second. I thought we have actually 17 races this year.
Well, we do, because Balaton Ring isn't going to be run because they're not
right. So if there was a Balaton Ring, then we would have had 18.
Correct.
We have 18 next time, and there's a new Spanish round. So what's gone?
Well, no. They haven't killed anything. They call it a reserve circuit.
Oh, I see. So we got 18 plus 1. Got it.
It's Plan B.
So the reserve circuit is Plan B.
Yeah.
Got it.
So, yeah. No, that's kind of cool. And do you want to talk about the Moto One panderings or
no,
what?
No. Let's save that for the next show, because obviously we've got no racing for a couple of weeks. We've got... Brno is not for 3 weeks in MotoGP. The next World Superbike race is not for 6 weeks. So, well, 5 by the time you're listening to this. But we're going to have a lot to talk about. I have a ton of notes that we could have talked about today about the whole Lorenzo thing. We hopefully will know about more about the Honda Yamaha Lorenzo thing. We've got Aspar Ducati rumors, you know, Moto One, tons of stuff to talk about. So let's save that for the next show and wrap it up here. All right, so I think that we will talk again next week. It might be a short show because there's not. Well, we'll see how much news comes out. Okay, well, thank you very much, Jim, and we'll speak to you soon. Ciao.
Ciao.